right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. And once again, I'm letting you know that this is a rebroadcast of a show I did a little while back, and it's very appropriate for the time coming up on Gay Pride Day, as well as the continuing attack on women. And towards the end of the show, a very, very interesting segment about the possibilities of the future in terms of the cities we live in. And I'll let you know that this is a promise that this is the last time for quite some time that you will be getting a rebroadcast. I am about to begin a whole new series of shows based on what I discovered, the investigative journalism I took part in Sanford, Florida, the scene of the murder of Trayvon Martin back in February, and the scene of continuing struggle to make sure that this doesn't get swept under the rug, that this heinous crime does not get swept under the rug, and we're all expected to just sit back and accept it. So I'll be running interviews and stories based on the time I spent in Sanford. And next week I will feature a very special interview I just completed with Ethan McCord. You may remember Ethan McCord is the GI who was featured in the Collateral Murder video that was one of the first things released by WikiLeaks way back when, okay, just a couple years back when WikiLeaks first started putting stuff out. And Ethan is the GI who refused to allow the humanity to be robbed from the Iraqi people. After serving for an extended period in Iraq, Ethan was confronted with the wanton slaughter of Iraqi children, and he decided that he had to step up and do something, step up and act against what was the acceptable norm of behavior in the U.S. military in Iraq. And we'll be running that interview with Ethan next week. So right now, sit back and enjoy the show, and I look forward to joining you again next week with the beginning of a whole new series of new material each and every week. So stay tuned. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. All right, on this week's show, it's a jammed show, as I always say that, and it always is. And it seems like, you know, if I had another hour, I keep thinking, well, I could stretch it out and really have relaxed conversations. And then I realized I'd probably just stuff more interesting things into it. So at the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Patrick M. Condon. And Patrick, actually, he's the author of a book called 7 Rules for Sustainable Communities, Design Strategies for the Post-Carbon World. And Patrick argues that cities are among the major culprits in the production of greenhouse gas, and he has a plan to do something about that. So that'll be very interesting to talk to him about that. Before that, we'll be talking with David Heilbrunner, who's the co-director, writer, and co-producer of a film that came and went way too fast, The Stonewall Uprising. I've watched it a couple of times over the last couple of months and really wanted to talk with David about this. It's a really moving, very powerful film, so we'll be talking with him. But opening it up, people might remember a while back I had Dr. Leroy Carhart on the show. And Dr. Carhart is the medical director of the Abortion and Contraception Clinic of Nebraska. He was a good friend of Dr. Tiller's. And he presented a speech at the National Organization for Women conference in Boston. And I happened to come across an article that was basically built on or based on that speech. And I read it and I thought it was extremely important for people to hear the content of what he was saying. So Dr. Carhart is joining us now from his clinic in Nebraska. Dr. Carhart, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael, for having me.
Sure. In this speech, which, by the way, I think this is, it's one of those presentations of this article. It's fairly short, but really full of some very powerful, very well-argued and very powerful and gripping arguments for reproductive rights. And the title of this is Reproductive Rights in the 21st Century, The Effects of the Hyde Amendment. And you begin the article by saying that the legislatures, the legislative bodies in this country are out of control when it comes to decrying the need to create laws governing a woman's body. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Well, I think sort of like the Constitution, we hold these truths to be self-evident. I mean, the legislature in Nebraska now has contrived a somewhat absurd notion that the fetus at 20 weeks can experience pain, therefore no abortions after the 20th week can be allowed in the state to protect the fetus from pain. And that would include severe health risks to the, not even in the cases of severe health risks to the mother. And it also stipulates, of course, that if you do an abortion to save the mother, you have to do it. The primary concern has to be to save the fetus first, and then the mother's life is expendable, or at least takes second place, no matter what. That's one of the most recently ridiculous laws that's been passed. It seems like almost every state that has a predominant anti-choice legislature tries to outdo the rest of the states by coming up with sillier and sillier things that really don't affect abortion at all, but yet in reality make all abortions less able to be obtained, or make them just deny women the right to control their own fertility.
Well, when you talk about these laws, I mean, they're silly on one hand, but if you could just give people a sense of some of them, because when you get a sense of how many of these laws and what they're actually doing, it's more than silly. It's just, it's a terrible, terrible weight, I think, that people really aren't aware of.
Well, you know, I mean, they started out with some of the first laws to be passed 20 years ago were the Parental Notification Acts, or Parental Consent Acts, which said that before a young woman under the age of majority in whatever state it was 17, 18, or 19, depending on what the state, each individual state might recognize, before they could have an abortion, they had to get the consent of either one or both parents. On the surface, that sounds very, very maybe logical, but that's because you and I grew up in a family, and most of America grew up in a family relationship where parents were supportive. But very often the women that we see that are being required to get this consent have been raped by the stepfather or the younger child or the cousin or the son, the brother, that they just don't, family has not been there for them in the first place. So they really can't, they can't get the consent of the person. That's one of the most subtle. Other laws, 24-hour waiting periods, where, you know, that makes the patient come in twice to be seen before they can. Some states it's 24 hours, some states it's 12 hours, and I don't know, I think one actually is 48 hours. They have to make a trip to the abortion clinic. Well, abortion clinics are only in about 11% of the counties of the United States, so that means that 88% of the women have to travel some considerable distance, and in this state, some women are 10 hours away. And 12 hours away, patients that I see routinely. I think 4 years ago, our average patient that we went and did a study on traveled over 4 hours to get to the clinic. So that means they would either have to come and get a motel room and stay overnight. And this ostensibly is to give them time to think about their decision. But I have to reassure you that in the 20 years I've been doing abortions, it's been nothing else that these women have thought about for the 6, 8, or 20 weeks before they've actually came into the clinic about what's the right choice. It's really just absurd.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Dr. Leroy Carhart, Medical Director of the Abortion and Contraception Clinic of Nebraska, and we're talking about the effects of the Hyde Amendment on women. Now, Dr. Carr, one of the laws that actually I think rolls off of people's tongues and has just been too easily accepted, it's sort of there, it's in the process, it's just there, there's nothing you can do about it, everybody refers to it. But you make the argument that the Hyde Amendment in particular is a really dangerous, it puts women in the most dire of situations. Can you explain what the Hyde Amendment is and why you would make that assessment?
The Hyde Amendment is something that, you know, it's been around for 34 years. However, it's been something that's been repassed every year for the 34 years. This is not some outstanding law that was written in 1974 that set up some grand principle. It's just been an amendment tacked on, usually to a budget bill or some other bill that really is desperate to be getting through the House or Congress so that it gets passed without anyone really fighting it because it sounds good. And ostensibly what it says is that no federal government monies can be used to fund abortion. What that does, it denies abortion care for Medicaid patients or Medicare or Medi-Cal, whatever the state entity is that provides funding for health care. If they receive federal funds, they cannot use any of those funds towards abortion care. So that means even women that desperately need abortions for medical reasons cannot get funding. So it puts the people that really have, they're in the worst straits, the most dire strait financially, and it puts them at the greatest risk of having to have a child that will, in their mind, destroy their possibilities of getting out of whatever predicament they're in. I think the worst thing about the Hyde Amendment, I think it's intentionally racist. I think the people know that it keeps the poorer women from being able to control their fertility, being able to become important or equally important members of society by keeping them barefoot and pregnant.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's give people, you know, you told a couple of very moving stories of some women that you came across in your practice that were had this, you know, were put in this dire situation? Can you just give people a sense? Maybe you could pick one and just tell the, you know, the story of this woman, so people get a living sense of the life that many women are forced to live because of something like the Hyde Amendment.
Yeah, I can. We had one patient that, well, two or three patients come to mind desperately. We had one patient that had gone to a government-sponsored clinic and found out she was pregnant and was, you know, given no options towards abortion, even though she specifically told them that she had reasons why she couldn't carry the pregnancy. And then, but she was told that it was not available. So then she ended up going through, actually she found a clinic, but by the time she got to that clinic, she was too far along. And then there was a second clinic that was, that she was referred to, that actually she drove over 400 miles to get to, and then when she got there, they couldn't see her because she hadn't met some of their state hoops that they had to jump through, so she left that clinic, and eventually she ended up getting referred to us, and by that time she had had to pawn her car, not to pay for the abortion, because she had absolutely no money to pay for the abortion anyway, but to pay for the transportation of getting back home from the second clinic she was at. They sold the car and bought a bus ticket to get back home with. And then she, you know, finally found us, and we were able to get funding completely for her abortion, get her funded for the abortion and get her funding to get here. But by the time she got here, she's now not 12 or 13 weeks pregnant, which she was when she first started out, but she's up in the almost near 20 weeks. So, you know, she's forced to go through all of these hoops, and yet still, you know, I mean, she finally got the abortion that she would have liked to have had at 8 or 9 weeks. It could have been very simply done in a doctor's office near her home, but instead of that, she spent everything she had, lost her car, lost everything, to try to get the health care that she needs.
Now, some of these young women, too, some of the other stories you've told, some of these young women are actually seriously considering suicide or punching themselves in the stomach to try and, basically terminate the pregnancy, right?
Yeah. You know, that's this conceived notion about an unwanted pregnancy and or unplanned pregnancies and all that. And, you know, most Americans that I know are results of unplanned pregnancies. But there's a tremendous difference between the unplanned pregnancy and the actually intolerable a patient that's pregnant because of either a rape or because of something that happened that the fetus or the pregnancy is destroying her emotionally. And there was a young woman that we ended up seeing that she had said every day, just when she was in college, she'd walk by the dorm, and I guess the way their dorm was set up, they had ledges that they could go outside, and she would go out on that ledge and think about jumping, that it would solve the problems. Or when she was riding in her car, she'd think about driving into bridge abutments because she just couldn't get the abortion that she needed. Women that are desperately... You know, I mean, yeah, I see the pregnant women that you ask them, you know, well, what would you do if you had to have this baby? And this one girl's response to me, it was, you just don't understand. This baby is not going to be born. I will die first.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
You know, I mean, it's mental health might, you know, we lock her away in a mental institution maybe and keep her alive. But I am sure that would be, you know, a lifetime thing, because she's not going to rebound from the delivery.
Right. And that, you imagine how many times over that story is run out in among the millions of women in this country that are denied abortion in one way or another by this myriad of laws or by tradition or whatever, you know. And this is, you know, the fact that you exist, and I really do have to say this for people who aren't familiar with you, Leroy Carhart and his clinic in Nebraska have been under attack, and he's refused to step down. He's refused to back off of his commitment to serve women and to provide abortions on demand when needed. You know, when if a woman wants an abortion, then it's needed. That's that. And I know you've read in a number of places you've said that it's not so much this question of wanting and need. Actually, if you want it, you need it. You know, and this is a big step here. And I think I'd like to end this with, you know, two questions. One is, first off, this point of, you know, people have made the Hyde Amendment the point where, in a lot of ways, and especially, you know, the politicians have all made this, and the people that are supposed to be the progressives have all made this stand of, well, the Hyde Amendment, everybody accepts this. This is where you find your conciliation and compromise. And you're arguing that this is puts women in the most dire of situations. And I think, you know, it's very true what you're saying. It's also the question that you raise of, I'd ask you this. You raise a question of who should decide the fate of women's lives? And then I'd ask you why you keep doing what you do.
Well, I think my feeling is that the woman, we have a nonprofit fund, and our motto is trust women. I think that nobody can make a decision about whether the abortion is necessary. Nobody other than the woman that makes that decision herself. Now, she can take everybody else's opinion into consideration, and that's a great thing to do. But once she comes up with what she knows is the best thing for her in that pregnancy, there should be nobody that stands in her way in the form of government. I mean, most of these women have talked to their religious leaders, they've talked to their friends, they've talked to everybody they can find, and they know where they are and what they need to do. And I don't think government has a right to interject itself into that position any more than it does say all of a sudden tomorrow that it's illegal to do radical mastectomies for breast cancer. We don't think that's the right thing to do. And it's a decision that your government could make, the same as saying that you can't have an abortion if you need one.
And absent that right is akin to keeping women enslaved, basically.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So, real quick, why do you continue to do what you do?
Well, first of all, somebody has to do it. I just, you know, to deny, if you take away the availability, then whether or not it's legal doesn't make any difference. I'm 68. I'm getting old to the point that I would have retired doing almost anything else in medicine. But there's a need right now, and there's a shortage of providers nationally. When I started 20 years ago, there were over 3,000 people doing abortions. Now there are less than, I think 1,700 was the last number from about 3 years ago, and I'm sure that number's dropped quite a bit. And many people that do them will only go to the first 12 or first 16 weeks of after the last menstrual cycle. So it leaves a lot of women that don't find out that they're pregnant until well into the pregnancy, or that have been given false information. We have people with seriously flawed pregnancies that are told by their doctor that everything is fine until the 24th or 25th week, and then they'll say, well, we've known about this problem all along, but we didn't want you to have to worry about it. And I just recently saw a patient like that. It's, somebody needs to be able to take care of them, and there's less than a dozen of us left in this country that are willing to do that. And
it's an intolerable situation, and actually argues even more forcefully that when people like you come under attack, people have got to stand up and defend you and stand with you. Dr. Carhart, thank you very much for joining us today.
Michael, thank you for the offering to be on your show.
Sure, and talk to you again soon. Bye now. I'm Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Dr. Leroy Carhart. And Dr. Carhart is the director of the Abortion and Contraception Clinic of Nebraska. And we've been talking about the impact of the Hyde Amendment on women's lives. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with David Heilbrunner, the co-director of this film, amazing, great film, Stonewall Uprising. So stay tuned.
Rebellious love is begging door to door, but finds the silence like no one lives there anymore.
Welcome back. It's Rebellious Love from Go Go Bordello, and I thought that would be an appropriate song to introduce this segment of the show. Joining us now is David Heilbronner. He's the co-director, writer, co-producer of the film Stonewall Uprising. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. I want to give people a real quick sense of the film. So I'm going to play just the first couple of minutes of it, and then we'll come back and talk about it, okay?
Go for it.
Okay. So let's listen to the first couple of minutes of Stonewall Uprising.
For me, there was no bar like the Stonewall, because the Stonewall was like the watering hole on the Savannah, you know, or on, you know, it was just everybody was there. We were all there.
Well, gay bars were the social centers of gay life. Gay bars were to gay people what churches were to blacks in the South.
There were no instructions except put them out of business. The first police officer that came in with our group said, the place is under arrest. When you exit, have some identification, and it'll be over in a short time. This time they said, we're not going. That's it. We're not going.
Something snapped. It's like, what's this? This is not right.
That's what happened strong all night to a lot of people. We went, oh my God. I'm not alone. There are other people that feel exactly the same way.
Didn't have the manpower, and the manpower for the other side was coming like there was a real war, and that's what it was a war.
This was the Rosa Parks moment, the time that gay people stood up and said no. And once that happened, the whole house of cards that was the system of oppression of gay people started to crumble.
In the civil rights movement, we ran from the police. In the peace movement, we ran from the police. That night, the police ran from us. The lowliest of the low. And it was fantastic.
That's it. It was fantastic. David, a brilliant film, really a great film. Can you explain to people, because there are many people living today who have no sense of what the Stonewall Uprising was and what it was about. Can you explain to people that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, let's start with setting the scene. It took place June of 1969, and America in 1969 was a vastly more homophobic, oppressive place than it is now. I mean, this election season, people are talking about gay marriage. In 1969, gay sex was illegal in every state in the country except Illinois. You couldn't be a doctor, you couldn't be a licensed lawyer, you couldn't be a school teacher, you couldn't even be a beautician because you needed a license to be a beautician. So the whole idea of being in and out of the closet just didn't exist. One place people could come was New York City, where they found, oh, it's a little bit more liberal, homosexuals are kind of tolerated. And they were a little bit in the Village, on Christopher Street in particular, which is where the Stonewall Bar was located. But the city itself was run by Mayor Lindsay, who engaged in a huge crackdown on gay people and gay bars in particular. To further set the scene, it was illegal to have a bar that served gay people. The presence of two or more gay patrons in a bar rendered the place subject to being closed by the liquor authority. So the only people who would set up a bar, openly gay bars, were the mafia. And so all the gay bars in New York City were run by the mafia, which is already, you can see this is trouble brewing. There were payoffs to the cops and crackdowns, and then these bars would reopen. And during this whole period, in that summer of 69, gay people were just being herded en masse into police cars. You couldn't even cross-dress. If you cross-dressed, you were subject to arrest. And the situation just became intolerable. It was like a pressure cooker. And the Stonewall Bar was probably one of the most popular gay bars in the city, although it was, as one patron said, it was a toilet. It was, you know, it had blacked out windows and watered down drinks and It was run by mafiosi who could care less about being gay. There was no gay rights didn't exist as far as they were concerned. They just charged twice as much money for watered down liquor. And one night, June 27th, the cops just raided the bar one more time. And instead of everybody saying, "Okay, here's my ID, you know, please let me go, don't take me downtown," they went, "No, I'm sick and tired of this. We're not putting up with it." And an incredible series of events took place. The cops were eventually barricaded inside the bar, holding a few gay clients hostage as the streets outside just went nuts. The village erupted with hundreds and hundreds of people throwing Molotov cocktails and turning over or smashing the windows of cop cars. And riot squad came, and all hell broke loose. And that's really the beginning of what was a four-day event known as the Stonewall Uprising.
And that uprising actually gave rise to even, frankly, was the catalyst for the establishment of much of the gay rights movement, and including Gay Pride Day, which is...
Gay Pride Day, as a lot of kids don't know, gay or straight, is celebrated every year on the anniversary of the Stonewall bar raid and uprising. And there had been a lot of gay rights organizations that had tried to get off the ground before that. The Mattachine Society, the Daughters of Bilitis, just to name the two most prominent ones. But they were all sort of waiting in line with their hat in hand, and everybody dressed up in this incredibly straight manner. The women all wore nylons and blouses, and the men all wore suits and ties. And, you know, this is 1969. In San Francisco, everybody's smoking dope and having group sex and listening to Grateful Dead and marching for women's rights and burning the flag and there's black rights. And to young gay people growing up, this was a bunch of BS. This is ridiculous. And it didn't seem to be getting anywhere. And so when the riots took place, politically minded young gay people said, "This is our moment. You know, we have the energy. The country's in the right place. We're going to turn this into something that will galvanize everyone around the country." And amazingly enough, it galvanized everybody around the world. I mean, to this day, Stonewall Uprising is now... The Gay Pride Parade, which is the celebration of the Stonewall Bar Raid, is celebrated in 80 countries. How many? Tens, hundreds of millions of people. So it was the birth of something. It's like the Rosa Parks moment or the storming of the Bastille. And we wanted to make this film, and we've been very lucky. It's gotten really good reviews and played all over the country, and it's going to be on PBS, which is cool that PBS would show it, in April of 2011. But we wanted to put gay history on the map as a part of American history. That this isn't just a story for gay people. It's a story about human rights. It's a story about human dignity. That just because of someone's sexual preference, you can't deny them. You can't lock them up in jail because they want to have sex with someone of the same gender, or deny them the right to be a lawyer or a doctor. You know. But in the 1940s, it seemed like, in the 60s, 40 years ago, it was unquestioned. It seemed like that was fine. And so it's nice to make a documentary where we have somewhat of a happy ending. You know, by the end of the film, you really reflect on how far we've come. And that's, you know, the film has been inspiring to a lot of people. We've had a lot of tears and cheering at screenings from gay and straight people.
At the same time, David, I have to say, it's a question of how far it's come. People have come from what you were describing earlier, and I want to talk about that a little bit more. But it's really a slap in the head, too, when you look at, look at the vehement opposition, the vitriolic, knuckle-dragging opposition to gay marriage. Or at the kinds of things that still go on today. The idea that some of the psychological things, some of the stuff that occurred in the superstructure or in the elan of the society. I mean, it was just sort of the whole atmosphere that existed in the 1960s. And people have to realize this was in the 1960s. That this kind of stuff existed, where you had Mike Wallace, or you had PSAs on television and movies and schools. You had cops coming in explaining how homosexuals were dangerous deviants after children. You know, and this
Mike Wallace is that we in the film. One of the things for those of you out there who haven't seen it, which is most everybody, because the film really only recently opened up. The film has a lot of what are now you can laugh at them, but at the time they were heartbreakingly critical. Television shows, one on CBS Reports, a major TV show hosted by Mike Wallace, and Wallace says things like, the average homosexual is incapable of or and not interested in a lasting relationship like that of a heterosexual marriage. And, you have gay guys today listening to that going, screw you, bub, were you joking? But it was spoken as if this was the unassailable truth, that gay people were deviants. They were considered mentally ill. They were sent to mental hospitals. They were subject to castration, lobotomy, medical experimentation, chemical waterboarding. They were given electroshock therapy it's called aversion therapy. They would be shown pictures of nude, if you were a guy, so pictures of nude males, and shocked. painfully every time you saw these photos, over and over and over again, like Clockwork Orange or something. So we have a long way to go, but it was so horrible just 40 years ago. It's difficult to really believe that. I have kids, and they've seen this film, and they go, like, you've got to be kidding me. You grew up in a world like that?
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with David Heilbrunner, who's the co-director of an amazing film, which we've just found out will be on PBS in April of 2011. People should search around trying to find it. It's really a well worth watching. It's just there's so much packed into this film, and you come away understanding a lot about what was and what is today and what should be. Actually, I think there's really some interesting stuff in it. And again, the name of the film is Stonewall Uprising. Now, David, you talked about the weight of all the things that happened to people, and we started to talk about some of the stuff that's going on in the superstructure. But there was a very moving line to me when somebody was one of the characters that you talked to, and you have a lot of people who were actual participants in the uprising, in the rebellion, and one of them says that the importance, and they describe how love between gay men had been so just dehumanized into literal meat markets in the back of meat trucks at the end of the workday. You know, you could be arrested for crimes against nature. And like you're saying, they were illegal in all but one state. But then you also had, he said, you don't know what a difference it made to be able to go into a place and slow dance with someone you loved. And when that was taken away, the impact that had on people was just a very beautiful moment in your film.
Thanks. Yeah, it's the Stonewall, you know, as scuzzy and downscale a place as it was, I mean, it really was run by an indifferent mafia who, you know, stole liquor off a truck hijacking, watered it down, and then charged twice as much, and forget sanitation, you know. And the place was really a bummer. It was still a refuge, and if you're a gay person where you can't express love out on the streets, you can't hold hands with your lover, or certainly kiss, you go into this place, and by God, you can slow dance to a song and express your love for someone, and that's, you know, that's a profound human need. I don't care if you're gay, straight, whatever. That's a profound human need. And then to have the cops come in there, right? You already can't express it on the street. You can't admit you're gay openly. You're forced to go to a horrible mafia bar because that's the only option. And even there, the cops are going to raid you. You know, that's when people went, enough is enough. You know, I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore. And one of the things I loved about that moment and about the film's meaning, if you will, is that political change, you know, sometimes sitting around waiting to be called on in the back of the class with your hand raised isn't the way to go. And it's something I loved about, you know, the 60s, having grown up through that era, and the 70s, is a revolutionary spirit that was there that said, no, you know, sometimes you have to demand your rights. You can't ask. You can't wait for Congress to get it together. And this was what happened with Stonewall Uprising. And it's a great reminder that sometimes history changes from the bottom up.
Let me ask you this. In one of the reviews of the film a while back, I read a comment from you about how you wanted to actually bring out to people the revolutionary side of the gay movement in the 60s and how this was actually part of that whole, you know, look, it was a time when revolution was in the air and in the mix. And this had a deep influence on people from every walk of life. And it's really struck me how much some of the people in the film would talk about, you know, I was in the anti-war movement. I walked with the Black Panthers. I wanted to, you know, all this. And there seemed to be a tremendous back and forth influence. And there really was a revolutionary edge to a lot of that.
Oh, it was huge. And, you know, it's kind of cool that by the second or third day of the riots in the village, it wasn't just gay people fighting the cops. You know, straight people joined in. The Panthers joined in. The hippies. There were anti-war movement people were joining in because it was a sense of people began to wake up and go, this is about human rights and we're all in it together. That's a kind of spirit that I find missing today from politics, I'm sorry to say, that I wish we saw more of.
All right, David, we're going to have to wrap it up, but I want to thank you very much for being here today and for the film, man. Really another great film.
Cool. Okay. Thanks so much. Great. I'm great to be here.
Take care now. I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Patrick Condon talking about how cities, the design of cities, contributes to the production of greenhouse gas and how changing that can actually be part of the solution. Welcome back. That's The Suburbs from Arcade Fire. And once again, leads right into what we've got to talk about today. A couple weeks ago, I came across a book called 7 Rules for Sustainable Communities: Design Strategies for the Post-Carbon World. I was really intrigued by the title and the description of it. It's by Patrick M. Condon, who's a professor of landscape architecture at the University of British Columbia. He has over 25 years' experience in sustainable urban design, first as a professional city planner and then as a teacher. And he's now a senior researcher with the University of British Columbia's Design Center for Sustainability and Urban Design Think Tank. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
Sure. Let's jump into this. You know, you make an argument that I think takes a lot of people by surprise. First off, you say that cities are a huge part of the problem in terms of the production of greenhouse gas. And this is something that's really weighing on a lot of people because, as many of us know, it's basically been laid out in a way that has never been laid out before, that if in the next 40 years, if there's not a drastic change, we could actually reach a tipping point where things couldn't be reversed in terms of greenhouse gas production, climate change, global warming, all that. Now, you argue that cities, by their very design, are a big part of the problem. Why and how?
Well, cities are the problem. I mean, when you think about it, pretty much everything we do, all that greenhouse gas that we produce is pretty much caused by the kinds of buildings that we either sleep in or work in and the way we get from one to the next, and then also the stuff we put in there. So the very configuration of that assembly of elements is the whole problem. And the second point to make on that is we already know that based on where you live, even in the United States itself, in any metropolitan area, just taking San Francisco as an example, if you live in the center city of San Francisco, your per capita production of greenhouse gases, consequent to your consumption patterns, where you live and how you move around, is about 25% of that of someone who lives further out in the valley. So it doesn't. It's not rocket science. It's people who live in low-density suburbs tend to drive a lot more. They tend to live in less efficient buildings, and that's the cause.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things, though, in terms of when you think about this, in terms of solution, because you also say, and I thought this was very interesting, you say, look, the answer won't simply come from technological innovation. I mean, look, there's a lot of people who argue for things like, you know, alternative fuel cars, you know, electric cars, or finding ways to reduce our footprint, which is important. But you argue that that alone won't do it. Why is that?
No, I mean, I'm sorry to say that it won't do it. Now, a lot of the emphasis today has as its assumption that there's some technological fix. But the greenhouse gas problem is basically an indicator of a larger set of lacks of sustainability in the big system and the big picture of things. You know, even if we could go to greenhouse gas zero in our vehicles, the demands of the system of city building that our present patterns of transportation and building arrangements require is not sustainable in a whole bunch of other indications. For example, just to give you one example, 5%, at least 5% of the greenhouse gas produced globally comes from simply the curing and production of concrete, and the majority of that is going into the creation of the highway system. So that's just one of many examples that we could cite that really requires to think about a way of at least slowly changing our behaviors on the planet and moving more gradually towards a system that doesn't make demands that are so severe on the planet, and most importantly, reduce our greenhouse gases.
Which brings us to the meat of the matter. You also have a solution that you argue for, and it's called 7 Rules for Sustainable Low-Carbon Communities. What are they? And then maybe you could briefly, in broad strokes, describe them, and we can get into a few after that.
Well, I know your listeners don't have a lot of time, so very briefly, the first rule is restore the streetcar city. And this is particularly important for the United States and Canada because our basic city structure, Los Angeles and San Francisco are great examples of this, grew out of the streetcar. And that was a period where we had very low greenhouse gas production. And many would argue we had even more mobility in those days than we do now on our congested freeways in both of those cities. The other rules tend to, in many cases, fit in to that larger and most important rule about the streetcar city. The very simple things that people can easily understand, like an interconnected street system instead of cul-de-sacs, maintaining a 5-minute walking distance to commercial services, making sure that jobs are evenly distributed close to homes, making sure that homes, affordable homes, are distributed close to jobs. And then also on the other side of the ledger relative to our demands on the water systems of the planet, create cities or restore cities that have a linked system of natural areas and parks, and finally use lighter, greener, cheaper, smarter infrastructure as opposed to the heavy, gray, expensive, stupid infrastructure, which is what we're doing now. So, you know, they're very simple and sort of straightforward rules, but the key to the rules, at least what I hope people understand, is that you have to do them all at the same time. And too often we think about solutions to problems one element at a time. Well, here's the transportation fix, here's the housing fix, here's the jobs fix, you know, and that doesn't work.
Yeah, I want to get into that a little bit later, because I think that's an extremely important and really intriguing, you know, view of this, of the solution here, of what you're proposing as a solution. I want to remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Patrick M. Condon, who's the author of Seven Rules for Sustainable Communities, Design Strategies for the Post-Carbon World, and it's from Island Press. It's a really great book, and really one that provokes a lot of thinking and really also does a lot of eye-opening. Now, Patrick, one of the things that you talk about when you talk about the streetcar cities, you know, just so people are clear, this isn't just a question of building streetcars. This is actually a concept that you've developed, right?
Yeah, it's metaphorical. You know, it's an easy way to think about things. And once you get your brain into that frame, it helps you understand a couple of things. One, it helps us understand that if we're to solve this problem, particularly in the United States, we need a particularly American solution. And fortunately, we have it right there in front of our eyes. Prior to 1950, we had a particular form of urbanism called the streetcar city. Not too many people talk about this fact, but places like Los Angeles and San Francisco, particularly Los Angeles, are streetcar city par excellence. And the emergence of the urban pattern, the American city, where people in the middle class had available to them for the first time things like single-family homes, the first time that ever happened was the emergence of the streetcar city. And yet, at the same time, we had these single-family homes, which came to be associated with the American dream in the 1950s and 60s, and erroneously associated with the so-called freedoms of the car, actually came at a period where we were all taking transit and walking and using bikes in what's called the streetcar city. So that's the form of urban blocks around an arterial. Often these arterials are in pretty rough shape now, but in bygone era they had wonderful access to basically greenhouse gas zero metropolitan transit systems, which, you know, in some cases are being restored. They're being restored in Portland with great success. Fortunately for Toronto, they never tore those down. So I'm basically saying that if we want to find a solution to the greenhouse gas problem in a way that's particularly suited to America, why are we inventing George Jetson solutions or assuming everybody's going to have a solar-powered car? Let's look at the basic fabric of our American city and try to understand what's good about it and try to restore those elements that we've lost.
Well, the fact that you mentioned George Jetson, okay, you're one of about 10 people I know besides myself who's intimately familiar with George Jetson, okay? But, basically it does get to this point, though, that, you know, these solutions, a lot of the times the solutions actually that people, that are sort of the sci-fi solutions, that it's good for people to be bending their minds and stretching the horizons of their thinking. But there's also things that you mentioned that there's inherent problems with, for instance, growing crops in huge concrete bunkers, you know, or high rises, or having everybody living in beehives, that actually, even as you mentioned earlier, that even the attempt to do this contributes even more because of what the production of all these massive materials, what it would take, what it would rob from the world. And I thought there was a very intriguing thing in terms of the way your solutions are very simple, yet very, very evolved and developed. And you do this in the embrace of the understanding that, as somebody, I can't remember who it was you quoted, but somebody who made the point that if the entire planet had the consumption levels of what people in North America alone have, it would take six planets to actually support that. That's your limiting factor. And then you've worked within that to develop something that could actually deal with this in a very reasonable and well thought out plan.
Yeah, that's who you're thinking of is Bill Rees, who's up here at the University of British Columbia, and the concept of the ecological footprint. and the six planets required. And yes, what I'm struggling with is to figure out a way within the framework or the limitations that imposes on us, with a view towards the social equity, that it's not okay for Americans or Europeans to grab all the world's resources forever. That's certainly not either ethically or practically sustainable forever. And that we have to assume that at some point the 8 or 9 or 10 billion people on the planet at some steady state are deserving of their own fair share. I'm trying to conceptualize in very simple terms what the form of such a city might be and how we could use the bones of the existing city, particularly in the United States, as the framework for that. And thus phrased, the question, it sort of was like a duh answer for me. It's sort of like, well, we already have that city, and we already had that city, and most of the streets that most people in America walk on are from that, are a legacy of a period that actually worked. And a lot of the things we like about America came from that period. Let's just work from that framework. It would be a disaster to tear down all that, which they're busily doing in places like Detroit as we speak, by the way, and replace it with some kind of beehive, you know, technological exuberance that makes no sense at all, because the resources required for that, A, are unaffordable, and B, it's a culture that's totally not aligned with the one that we happen to live in.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about a very important aspect of your plan, which is the sort of the point that gets to more the quality of life on one level, but is also essential to the functioning of the rest of the plan, as is each element, and that's the linking parks, nature areas, as well as the green infrastructure, but particularly the role of nature incorporated in as part of your design, as a living part of your design.
Well, I think that's hugely important, and as a landscape architect, that's where I kind of come to the problem from, is the dual requirement of a functioning city needs to work with natural systems rather than against it, for very practical reasons, because it's very costly not to do so, and you know, it's just plain stupid to work against them when you can work so beautifully with them. And also, parallel to that, the elements of the city that are most uplifting and healthy for people are typically those parts of the city that link them and their neighborhoods and their workplaces to the natural phenomenon that nature affords, whether it's the Hudson River or Central Park or the Pacific Coast or even a small neighborhood park with a single tree that you can sit under. Those all are part of healthy urban living and very much part of the American culture at its best. So I make an example out of the work of an early landscape architect called Frederick Law Olmsted. And those of your listeners who've been to Boston who might live there are familiar with it in the form of what's called the Emerald Necklace, which is a terrific project that stretches all the way from downtown Boston out to Prospect Park and beyond. Sorry, not Prospect Park, out to Franklin Park and beyond, some 15 miles of green infrastructure. And, you know, that's a great example of taking natural systems, which was a natural drainage way, and using that as what I call an armature, or what other people might call a framework for a livable and healthy and affordable city, a place where you can walk, a place where nature is appreciated, a place where you can bike, and a place with neighborhoods that relate to nature.
Mm-hmm. One last question, Patrick. You mentioned this earlier about you can't sort of cherry pick one element or two elements of this plan, that it's an integral whole. Why is that, and why is it important to recognize that?
Well, it's important to recognize that because the whole reason we're in the mess that we're in, Michael, is because we've thought about things as singular entities. So we have a transportation problem, we build a freeway. We have a housing problem, we build a high-rise for the poor. You know, we have an economic development problem, we build, you know, office parks in the middle of nowhere. And we have a, you know, environmental problem, and we put fences around nature reserves. You know, we've developed, basically in the 20th century, a habit of thinking which is pathological and is leading us to be totally incapable of solutions that require systems thinking. Instead, we have to think not about singular solutions, but entire systems. Now, that's easy to say, but very hard for people to do. And that's why I tried to make a book that simplifies the kind of obvious. I actually think when you get right down to it, it's not that hard. You have to think about all things at the same time. But let's just take a hard look at the country that we live in, the natural systems that it sits within, the history of our country, and what we can possibly do to reconstruct it in a way that doesn't suck the planet dry.
All right, Patrick, and on that note, I want to thank you very much and encourage people to get your book. It's 7 Rules for Sustainable Communities, Design Strategies for the Post-Carbon World, and it's from Island Press. Really, just a very thought-provoking book. Thank you very much, Patrick.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Take care now. You've been listening to Patrick M. Condon talk with me about 7 rules for sustainable communities. How are we going to deal with this global warming, the climate crisis, the fact that the Earth is hurtling towards the point of no return, a very dangerous situation. And Patrick has actually developed an understanding or a plan that he's proposed for how to deal with this, one critical component of how to deal with this. Now, I want to take a couple of seconds before we actually end the show. And let's say a couple of things. One is, think about this. This is the kind of world that we could be living in. This is the kind of world that we should be living in, where people are able to stretch their minds to think that they can come up with these kinds of plans to live a reasonable, to live a reason, to live a life where people actually interact with nature, and not gearing everything towards finding the ways to more intensely exploit nature for profit. Now look, if you've ever thought about living in a different kind of world, then you've probably also had to think about why things are the way they are in this world. Why can't we live in a rational relationship with nature and in a cooperative relationship with each other? What the hell's going on with that? Why can't we all have health care and the basic right to eat? Why can't cities be designed to enhance human life and relationships, like Patrick's been talking about, instead of endangering the planet and the very existence of the human race itself? In a talk entitled, Why We're in the Situation We're in Today and What to Do About It, A Thoroughly Rotten System and the Need for Revolution, Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, speaks directly to this.
But let's step back even more fundamentally than that. In order to understand what the problem is in the world, there are, in a sense, 2 words we could focus on. Those 2 words are preliminary transformation. These are words that Marx used in describing how capitalism operates and has to operate. Or we could actually expand it and say there are really 4 words. Preliminary transformation into capital. Now, what Marx was talking about and what's crucial to grasp is the way in which, for anything to be done, specifically in the sphere of economics, which is the foundation of all societies and of all systems, in order for anything to be done within the realm of capitalism and in line with the dynamics of capitalism, things, and in particular a form of social wealth, money or whatever, has to undergo a preliminary transformation into capital. In other words, if you're talking about building housing, for example, under capitalism, this has to be done through the dynamics of how the capitalist system operates, and it has to be invested in a way that turns that investment into capital. Now, what do I mean by capital? Most fundamentally, control over and use of the labor power of others. So capital, for example, you have a stock of money. How do you make it undergo the preliminary transformation into capital? Money just sitting there doing nothing is not capital. It's just money. If it were money in the hands of a socialist government, we'd sit around and look at and say, what are the social needs, and how do we apply this accumulated wealth to meet those social needs in the context of everything else? Because we wouldn't have to undergo the preliminary transformation into capital. But a capitalist or a capitalist system fundamentally cannot do that. They have to say, how can we invest this in labor power, in raw materials, in means of transportation, and so on, which will be most profitable for us? The defining feature of capitalism is profit in command.
That was Bob Avakian, and if you want to hear the whole talk this clip was taken from, you can find it at bobavakian.net. Looking back at the show today, you know, it had a general theme about the rotten life we're forced to live in this society and the kind of life we should be and could be living if things were fundamentally changed, if they were changed in a revolutionary way. And in light of this, especially the issue of the kind of world we could be living in, I wanted to let everybody know that the Revolutionary Communist Party recently announced that it's going to be publishing a draft proposal for the constitution of the new socialist republic in North America. Yeah, you heard it right. Now, how audacious can that get? Now, this has a whole lot to do with throwing off that terrible weight that so many people carry with them in this society. The idea that this is the best we can do, that this is the only way humans can live. Nothing else is possible. Well, this constitution busts right through all that. And it promises to be both a historic and visionary model for a future socialist society right here in North America. It'll give people a concrete sense and a deep understanding for just how we could usher in and run a whole new world, one that would flourish and where people would want to live. So keep your eyes open for this. Once again, you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, and my production assistant, Henry Carson. I also want to thank all of my guests and all of you for tuning in. And if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with Downpresser Man from Peter Tosh. Downpresser Man, where are you going to run to? I'll be talking with you again next week.
Downpresser Man, where are you going to run to? Downpresser Man, where are you going to run to? Downpresser Man, where are you going to run to? All along that day, you're going to run to the sea, but the sea will be boiling when you run to the sea. The sea will be boiling when you run to the sea. The sea will be boiling all along that day. You're gonna run to the rocks. The rocks will be melting when you run to the rocks. The blue rocks will be melting when you run to the rocks. The rocks will be melting, I said, all along that day. So I said, down, press a man, where you gonna run to? I said, down, press a man, where you gonna run to? I said, champagne.